4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, a program where we ask the question, what does it mean to be living in the new geologic age? I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today's interview is with Ken Herkenhoff. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Miles, and I'm here today with Dr. Ken Herkenhoff, planetary geologist with the USGS. Dr. Herkenhoff, thank you very much for sitting down with me today.
All right. Thanks, Miles. Good to be here.
So I wanted to begin with Mars itself before we sort of dive into Curiosity, because you are part of the Curiosity team. What did we know about Mars before we got there, you know, before Curiosity even landed? So to begin with, can you explain briefly what planetary geologists mean when they refer to the Martian dichotomy?
The Martian dichotomy is a huge difference in topography we see in the basically the northern and southern hemispheres of Mars. The southern hemisphere of Mars is the cratered highlands, very similar to the cratered highlands we see on the moon, while the entire northern hemisphere of Mars is a lowland, a plain that stretches, you know, almost halfway across Mars and is less heavily cratered.
So it's pretty smooth in the north and pretty jagged in the south.
That's right. Yes.
For reference, roughly where did the Mars Curiosity rover land?
Curiosity landed in Gale Crater, which is near just south of the equator on Mars. It's a 150-kilometer diameter crater that has some interesting sediments remaining in the center of the crater that are the prime focus of the mission.
Okay, so moving on to Curiosity. You're focused on the ChemCam. What exactly is that?
That's a new type of instrument. It uses a technology called laser-induced breakdown spectroscopy. And what that does is it focuses a laser beam on the rocks or soils up to 7 meters away from the rover and pulses the laser with enough energy to essentially ionize the surface. And so we get a little flash of light as the excited atoms recombine and emit photons that have specific energies that are diagnostic of the chemical elements within it.
And we've never been able to do this before on Mars.
This is the first instrument of this type that's been flown to Mars.
And there are other instruments on this as well.
That's right. What's really new on MSL is analytical chemistry and mineralogy capability. There are a couple of instruments inside the rover that need to be fed samples from rocks or soils on Mars to do their work. And we're just starting to check those out now. But they are much more sensitive to chemicals and minerals and organic materials as well than previous missions.
So before we dive into what you've discovered so far, I actually want to talk a little bit about the rover itself, kind of how big is it and how is it different than any of the other rovers that we've sent there?
It's much larger than the previous rovers. In fact, it's so large that it hasn't been able to use the same entry, descent, and landing system with airbags that the Pathfinder and Mars Exploration rovers used. MSL is too big for that, as I said. It's sort of the size of a Mini Cooper. It's not as long as a typical car, but it's a little wider. So it's a big vehicle, much heavier, almost a ton in weight. So yeah, we had to come up with a new way of landing on Mars to do that.
I'm sure that our audience has heard of the Sky Crane and all of that, but for those who haven't, could you maybe just walk through what it is and why that was so hard to do?
Yeah, they realized early on that MSL was going to be too big to land with the airbag system. The airbags just would have popped, basically, and you can't land that way. The rover is almost a ton in mass. So to land that, you need something else to stop it, and rockets are really one of the few alternatives. But what they realized is to land something that weighs almost a ton on Mars with rockets required really powerful rockets. And those rockets, when they got close to the surface, would stir up so much dust, sand, rock, that it could damage the rover. And so they came up with the Sky Crane approach, which involved, yes, rockets landing the rover, but first descending the rover on cables below this rocket pack as it approached the surface.
So the rocket pack never reached the ground.
That's right. It stayed about, I think it was 20 meters above the ground at landing. Even with that offset, the rockets were powerful enough to throw rocks and sand up onto the top of the rover. In fact, that's one of the few problems we've had in the whole mission, is that one of those rocks or dirt clods damaged one of the wind sensors on the meteorology mast. Fortunately, there are two wind sensors, and the other one is working fine, but there was enough material blown up on the rover that it caused a little bit of damage.
And just to clarify, you said MSL a couple of times. Can you tell us what that stands for?
I'm sorry. MSL is the Mars Science Laboratory. Curiosity is the nickname. But yeah, I've been calling it MSL for a long time.
So it'll be MSL. That's fine.
Forgive me.
No, that's fine. That's fine. So what has Curiosity seen so far?
Well, it's still very early in the mission, and we're still checking out some of the capabilities. So we haven't used all the instruments, but cameras are working well, and so we've seen things like conglomerates, a type of rock on Mars that is very similar to conglomerates on Earth that were laid down in floods or, you know, lots of water flowing and are pretty diagnostic of water flowing across the surface. So that was pretty exciting. It looks like we landed in the outer parts of an alluvial fan. This is a type of deposit on Earth that is formed by streams coming out of canyons, and it looks like we're seeing the same thing on Mars. So there was a lot of water flowing on Mars sometime in the past in the place that we landed.
You know, we have the chemical signature, which we can get from orbiting satellites and now on the ground with Curiosity. We have these conglomerates, which suggest water. We have, you know, pillow basalt. We have rough formations that look like, and these probably formed in the presence of water, alluvial fans. Is it kind of mission accomplished? You know, like we found water evidence of water?
Well, no, we're just getting started. And in fact, previous missions have pointed toward the involvement of lots of water on Mars for years. The Mariner 9 and Viking orbiters showed huge stream cut, water cut valleys early in the 70s. So we've known that there was water on Mars, at least for a time, back in those early days.
It's important to state that the mission of Curiosity is not to discover life. It's looking for evidence of an environment that might have supported life or could support life.
That's exactly right. And so Curiosity, MSL, is not a life detection mission. It's very hard to detect life on Mars. And the Viking landers tried, and those results are still being debated. So instead, yes, we're focused on trying to determine what the environment was like, seeing if there are organic materials that could have been the building blocks of life or left over from when life was present on Mars. But to really answer that question of whether there was life or is life on Mars, we need to get samples back into terrestrial laboratories.
Other than the obvious, going back to what I was saying, Curiosity is not there to find life. But other than the obvious of Curiosity finding life on Mars, give me a top three most important discoveries that you think Curiosity can make.
Wow. Finding organics would be huge. That's going to be tough because the Martian surface is so highly oxidized right now that organics on the surface will break down very quickly. So most likely we'll have to find the organics in drill samples. And Opportunity does have a drill that can get below the surface deep enough that organics would be stable there.
How far below the surface?
It's about 5 centimeters, so, okay, you know, a couple inches or so. But that's going to be hard to do. So we have to find the right rocks, get them drilled, get them into the instrument to find organics. So that would be finding organics would be touchdown.
You still have 2 and 3.
Oh, 2 and 3. Yes. Sorry. I would love to see more evidence for lake beds. We've seen evidence for water flowing across Mars, but quiet, stable water that's quiet and stable for long enough to form lake bed sediments, or better yet, even seafloor sediments, would be a great finding, because you need some kind of an environment like that, water stable for a long period of time, to allow life to originate. Let me think about number three. Well, of course, if we found images of a fossilized life, that would be really exciting. But I think that's the least likely.
I'm curious. I'm sure this is a question that you get all the time, but why do this? Why go to Mars? What do we learn about ourselves on Earth by discovering that there was water on Mars or organics on Mars?
Well, there's a couple answers to that. One is just satisfying human curiosity. I think humans naturally are curious beings. And for me, that's the most compelling answer. But another important answer is that we're doing things that nobody else can do. It's a source of American pride. I think even our enemies are probably amazed at the things that America can do, totally peacefully. It should be a source of great pride for all Americans. In addition, Mars is probably the next destination for human explorers. And so a lot of the things that MSL, Curiosity, is doing right now is paving the way for that next stage of exploration. For example, there's a radiation detector on the rover that measures the high energy particles from the sun and cosmic rays that would be damaging the human tissue if humans were there. So understanding exactly what that radiation dose is will help us plan for human exploration.
The Apollo era seemed to really galvanize the states, and I would even argue the world. But since then, there's been this sort of diminishing interest in space exploration and planetary exploration. But somehow, landing a $2.5 billion atomic robot on the surface of Mars from a rocket-powered sky crane has taken on this significant social meaning. And I'm curious, why do you think that Curiosity has gained that social significance when these other missions didn't?
It's a good question, and I think a lot of it is just the incredible technological feat. When I first heard about the way the sky crane landing approach, I said, "Are you kidding? I mean, you know, this has got to be the hardest way to land on Mars." But I realized after having worked with the engineers at JPL for many years that if anybody could do it, they can, and they did. And I think that's really the main thing that people get is that it's an astounding technological achievement. It shows what humans can do if they put their mind to it.
One of the things that I found very intriguing about Curiosity is that it's sort of anthropomorphic. You know, it's got these arms and it's got this neck and it's got this head with the camera aperture. It looks a lot like Wall-E.
Yes.
It's kind of like, is it viewed as kind of a big house pet?
Well, we refer to her as she. So, yeah, there is, you know, it's sort of like our little baby on Mars. It's not fair to my children compared to having a kid. But it's sort of like that. It's been the same way with the Spirit and Opportunity. I mean, you know, when Spirit, we realized Spirit was really gone and that mission was over, it was a sad day for all of us. It wasn't like losing a daughter, but it was painful all the same.
So there is an emotional attachment to this machine.
You know, especially after this many years, you really do get attached to it. And even the individual instruments, because you've put so much time and effort into them that they're, you know, a part of you.
What first got you interested in looking to Mars and looking to planets? And I heard a rumor it involved your great-grandmother.
Okay, I'm going to date myself. I think it was a Christmas gift in 1964, the Golden Book of Astronomy. And those of you who are old enough to remember 1964 know that very little was known about the planets. The satellites of the outer planets were just dots. No, you know, nobody had any idea of what they were. And so that fascinated me, just how little was known. And then I was lucky to grow up during the dawning of the space age and seeing some of the first flybys of Mercury, Mars, the outer planets. And you can only see something for the first time once. And that experience was wonderful. And I feel very fortunate to have had that experience.
Throughout history, science and exploration have always gone hand in hand. We sort of develop these technologies that allow us to go farther and farther out into nature and discover these new things. And with Apollo, we took those technologies with us to the moon and brought it back. And the astronauts themselves were the explorers.
Right.
And in our now highly technological sort of a society, it seems that we've sort of given up the human explorer in favor of virtual explorers. We're not sending people to Mars. We're sending robots.
Well, And we're lucky it worked out that way, because it is easier to send robots to Mars than it is to send humans. And so it's a good thing that computers have become so much more advanced, and instrumentation has advanced over those years so that we can do things on Mars that 30 years ago we could only dream of. But eventually, there's a place for human exploration. A human can do so much more on Mars than these robots that it's just going to be like night and day. So hopefully we'll get people there soon. That'll be fun to watch.
Well, Ken Erkinoff, thank you so much for sitting down with me today.
All right. Thanks, Miles. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank co-producers Tom Hayden and Miles Traer for all their behind-the-scenes work, as well as Leslie Chang, Maxine Luckett, and Sam Larson. Special thanks to Pam Madsen, Dean of Stanford's School of Earth Sciences. A very special thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song, Monoliths. Thanks also to KZSU Stanford 90.1, where all of our interviews were recorded. You can find past episodes of Generation Anthropocene at anthropocene.stanford.edu, follow us on Twitter, or like us on Facebook. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?